I am speaking with David Forsyth. He's university professor and the Charles J. Mock Distinguished Professor of Political Science Emeritus at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. He will be delivering the annual Phi Beta Kappa Visiting Scholar Lecture tonight, Tuesday, at Kalamazoo College's Mandel Hall in the Olmsted Room. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
The title of your lecture is The United States and Torture After 9/11. Let's step back first and get the baseline. On September 10th, 2001, was torture even an issue? Was it anything people were talking about in the halls of government?
Not in the halls of U.S. government for the United States, but in terms of our taking a leadership against torture around the world in other countries, yes, of course. We like to see ourselves as a leader for human rights, so we had tried to address the torture issue in other countries, yes, but not here at home.
And as you say, the United States, now referring to your book, The Politics of Prisoner Abuse, the United States is like many other countries in that it often falls short of its stated ideals on things like prisoner abuse.
Well, yes, but we have a rather high opinion of ourselves. There is this thing called American exceptionalism, and we tend to think of ourselves as an engine for progress in the world. This is a staple of both Republican politics and Democratic politics. Both parties claim a leadership role, active foreign policy, participation in international relations, very proud of creation of United Nations and NATO and World Bank and all of that about how Americans should take a leadership role in world affairs, also on human rights.
Is there always a balance between security and things like human rights, privacy, torture, those sort of things?
Yes, and we these days see it every day. Should we spy on Americans? Should we intercept phone calls and emails abroad and at home? Yes, and I think even if you go way back in the history of the country, this tension between the security of the group as a whole versus individual rights and individual freedoms is a constant tension. And I think it's a fundamental question of all governments as to where that balance lies between security and individual freedom, individual rights.
So then we had September 11th, 2001, massive terrorist attacks on United States soil, the worst ones we had seen to date and have seen since. Did that shift the balance dramatically?
It did. Not only for the George W. Bush administration, but I think you see it also in the Barack Obama administration now with the extent of spying and extent of drone strikes abroad. The balance definitely during the George W. Bush administration tilted toward protecting the group at the expense of individual rights. They were determined that there should be no other 9/11. They were determined that there would not be other terrorist attacks like that. And the gloves came off, as some said explicitly. Vice President Cheney was quoted as saying, we have to go to the dark side. There's a book by that title which traces a lot of this. And so, yes, the balance definitely tilted toward protection of the group at the expense of individual rights, particularly the individual rights of foreign enemies.
You mentioned President Obama. He's been in office now for coming up on 5 years. Has there been much of a change in U.S. policy in this area since he took office?
Yes and no. There's been a change on treatment of prisoners, yet he has continued with other policies and expanded other policies that started in the Bush administration, such as drone strikes. He's been very tough with drone strikes, and the number of drone strikes in places like Northwest Pakistan have greatly expanded under Obama, and we have expanded drone strikes to Yemen and Somalia and other places. And in general, I would say the Obama administration has tried to block American courts from reviewing a lot of detention policies. But in terms of severe abuse of prisoners, And avoiding federal courts altogether, I would say there's been a significant change between the Bush administration and the Obama administration.
Now, as we sit here and talk, it's November 5th, 2013, so it's been over 12 years since the terrorist attacks on the United States. There has not been another major successful attack in the U.S. Won't a lot of people look at that piece of information and say whatever the Bush administration and the Obama administration had to do to get us to this point is justified?
Some will. Some will take a different approach and say, well, we have shown the ability to deter a lot of these attacks. We have intercepted a number, the Detroit underwear bomber and all of that. And so since we apparently have sort of Al-Qaeda central on the run, we don't have to torture. We can use humane interrogation. We can use the federal courts. This is what Obama wants to do anyway, and Attorney General Holder. They believe the federal courts are perfectly capable of handling these terrorism cases. They really don't want to use the military commissions that are still going on in Guantanamo. And the fact that there haven't been other successful major attacks linked to Islamic extremists abroad, with the exception of the Boston Marathon bombers, means to some people that you don't have to torture, you can ease up, you can use normal criminal justice. Different people will take different interpretations about what it means that we haven't had other 9/11s since that date.
There's a professor here at Western Michigan University, a philosophy professor by the name of Fritz Ahlhoff. He's written a book which more or less argues that in some cases torture can be justified by what he calls ticking time bomb scenarios. There's information that we believe somebody has. We have only so much time to get it before there's an attack. Did the United States go beyond ticking time bomb scenarios, as far as you can tell, in terms of the torture that was used on detainees?
Yes, I would say, and I think you phrase it well insofar as we can tell, because I would like to emphasize that no outsider knows exactly what has transpired in the past. We think we know the general outlines of what happened in the CIA prisons and Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib and all of that, but it'll be decades before the documents are released telling us exactly what happened. But as far as I know, having researched this subject for a decade or so, I know of no imminent terrorist attack that was intercepted and blocked because we had tough interrogation techniques through the CIA and the military, 2002, 2003, 2004, at the height of the abuse. I know of no evidence that's been released that shows that we were in a kind of ticking time bomb situation, and tough interrogation really interrupted those plans. I know of no example that way.
We've talked about the Bush administration, the Obama administration, but of course we have two other branches of government which are supposed to be co-equal branches. What role has Congress played in any of this, if any?
Congress played a very important role, but with a loophole. And the courts have sometimes been important. The Congress in about 2005 passed some legislation called the Detainee Treatment Act, which was a pushback against the Bush administration, requiring particularly the U.S. military to follow the Geneva Conventions and traditional military law and U.S. military manuals about interrogation and detention of enemy prisoners. And so certainly from about 2005, if not before, the military at Guantanamo and in Iraq and Afghanistan changed some policies and engaged in detention and interrogation in keeping with what's called international humanitarian law or laws of war. There was a loophole and a big fight in Congress because the CIA was not covered by this legislation, only the military. And there were people in Congress like John McCain and others who wanted it to pertain to the CIA as well as the military, but the Bush administration fought for a kind of loophole, and they got it. But nevertheless, as far as military detention is concerned, there was a pushback by Congress, and it was bipartisan, and you had a number of leading Republican members of Congress joining with Democrats to pass this legislation. Likewise with the courts, you can see occasionally some important court cases. The U.S. Supreme Court has held, for example, that everyone held at Guantanamo is covered by a part of the 1949 Geneva Conventions on Laws of War. That was a very important ruling because the Bush administration intended the Guantanamo prison to be a legal black hole, not covered by international law, not covered by American law, not covered by Cuban law. And the Supreme Court said, no, no, the treaty does apply, international law does apply to those people. So there was a particular court case. On the other hand, I would say that U.S. federal courts have not seriously restricted what the executive wanted to do in most cases.
And is what we're talking about here perhaps the best example of why we do need checks and balances, that we have a constitution, it's supposed to be followed, and yet there are extenuating circumstances, which most, as you say in your book, most presidential administrations would probably have taken some extraordinary steps after the events of September 11th, 2001. Does that make the argument for checks and balances to try and rein that in and ask the questions about what's appropriate and what's not?
Yes, very much so. But there is a huge political problem which can be seen across the decades, and that is in a crisis, when the country feels itself under serious threat, power flows to the executive branch and the checks and balances break down. So if you go back and you look at FDR during World War II, if you look at Harry Truman during the Korean War, if you look at recently as Bill Clinton in bombing campaigns against Serbia in the Balkans, when the president says he needs to use force or he needs to get tough, when the country feels under attack, Congress and the courts prove pretty much deferential. And so you have the Gulf of Tonkin resolution back in the Lyndon Johnson years, and then you, after 9/11, you had Congress passing this authorization to use military force, which was vague and open-ended, kind of like the Gulf of Tonkin resolution. So the idea of checks and balances is very good in theory and on paper, but in reality, crisis leads to the imperial presidency. And from World War II, and especially from the Korean War, we seem to have had a whole series of crises where the president says he needs to use force, and it takes a while for Congress to begin to exercise checks and balances. It takes a while for the courts to be willing to contest what the political branches are doing. And in the Detainee Treatment Act, which I mentioned, by Congress requiring the military to engage in humane interrogation and detention, this was 2005, whereas the attacks were 2001. So the Bush administration had a kind of free hand there from the Congress for about 4 years. And that's rather typical. And so checks and balances tend to break down, and we have wound up with an imperial presidency because we are said to face these constant crises of national security.
To look back at history for a little bit, you mentioned some of the actions taken, say, in World War II, internment of Japanese Americans, for instance. But there was a war going on which ultimately ended in 1945. Obviously, there were still long-term effects, but someone might look back at World War II and say the extraordinary measures taken had an end point, whereas with what happened in 2001, we have pretty much been told that we're in essence, a never-ending war. That phrase has been used. Does that mean that the measures taken continue, and is that what we have to look forward to?
Well, some measures continue, and you raise a very important question, and I don't know if you're aware, but legally and technically, the Korean War has never ended. We just had an armistice, and so we never had a peace treaty. And in fact, the military will use that sometimes to expand a military airport, saying we need to take civilian property or whatever, because technically we're still at war. We still face a national emergency running from 1950 in Korea. So sometimes the executive branch finds this very useful. But it's a very serious question because what's at issue here is whether in the country we have sort of normal law, normal due process, normal civil liberties, normal use of courts. That's the sort of criminal justice model, you know, and when we capture people and detain people, whether we treat them as common criminals who are charged with murder, for example, or whether we get away from our regular law and due process and use a kind of law of war model where the normal rules of due process don't apply. We have the law of war model, which says while the war is going on, you can hold these detainees forever. You don't have to read them their Miranda rights. You don't have to give them other aspects of normal due process because it's the war model. And you can use military commissions, which have different rules of evidence and different rules of procedure from the federal court. So there are very important legal issues here about whether you say we are still in an armed conflict with armed non-state actors like al-Qaeda, or whether you say, as Obama has said recently, at some point that has to end and we have to get back to the criminal justice model of dealing with people who threaten the United States. Because you have a choice there as to whether you're going to use normal detention and interrogation rules and then put these people in the federal courts, or whether you're going to have administrative detention and other special rules and use military commissions. And that's very much still at issue in the country and debated by the Congress here a dozen years after 9/11.
What precedent has been set, not only here in the United States by the actions taken over those last dozen years, but also worldwide, where other countries, of course, are well aware of what has happened in the U.S.?
Yes. Well, in some ways, the U.S. has copied other countries, and we did consult with other countries in terms of our reactions after 9/11. We consulted with the British. We consulted with the Israelis. We also consulted with Saudi Arabia, which has been known to use torture on its detainees and so forth. But even, say, if we take the British and the Israelis, two of our closest allies, they have acted in a very tough way against those who challenge the security of those states. The British in Northern Ireland were very tough. The Israelis, in dealing with the Palestinians and other Arab parties, have been very tough. They have engaged in abusive interrogation. There's no question about that. I think we learned some of the techniques, not only from our own research, but from the Israelis and from the British. And they engage in administrative detention. They hold people without charge or trial for a period of time. The Israelis engage in a kind of secret detention for a while. They eventually put a lot of these people in the regular Israeli court system, but they will hold them for a couple of weeks at a time and hide them from visits from the International Committee of the Red Cross. So in a way, the American record during the Bush administration in particular was not totally different from what the British had done and what the Israelis had done. This doesn't make it legal. This doesn't make it right, but democracies, too, can be very tough when their security is threatened.
David Forsythe, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.